Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. And I am really excited about the podcast discussion that I'm going to be able to participate in today. A couple of weeks ago, recently in the province of Ontario, where we all live, Premier Doug Ford announced that it was his objective to appoint like-minded, in other words, Doug Ford type judges, and justice of the peace, I believe, to the judicial system in Ontario, the provincial courts, that sort of thing. And that immediately generated responses in the newspapers and discussion for people who are generally concerned about this. And I think this is a very important topic, raising a wide range of issues that certainly we'll at least identify today and explore some of them. And it is my great privilege today to be able to participate with Norman Douglas, Doug Judson, and members of the Compassionate Justice Committee in Toronto. A special shout out to them, Dan Lang, Ben Levin, and Jim Black. And I think I'd like to begin by asking each of you to introduce yourselves briefly. Norm, why don't I start with you?
Okay, thanks, John. First, thank you for inviting me. I am a retired, I'm speaking to you from Collingwood, my condo, and I've been retired now a couple of years. I was in the justice system for 50 years, 27 and a half as a criminal court judge, and 21 as in the Crown system. I was a Crown attorney and then a director of Crown attorneys and then the director of criminal prosecutions for Ontario before I got appointed to the bench in 1994. When you hit 75, it's a sayonara, you're out of here. And so I'm retired. I've written a couple of articles on this topic, and I'll be happy to share some of that as we go along.
That's fantastic. Thank you for that. And I also, reading your 360 article, see that you've recently written a book as well.
Thank you. The book is called You Be the Judge. Huh? It soars now. It was published by Irwin Law. It came out in December. It's basically a crash course on the criminal law, but mainly 24 cases that I was involved in, 12 as a prosecutor and 12 as a judge. Very difficult decisions in all of them. And basically, I invite the reader to sit beside me. And before I tell her or him what I did, the reader hears the case and makes a decision as the judge. And then they find out what I did and they get a chance to disagree with me.
Sounds fascinating.
Be the judge.
Mm-hmm. Great stuff. Doug, what's happening with you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. So my name is Doug Judson. I'm the chair of the Federation of Ontario Law Associations, more affectionately known as FOLA. We're a federation of the 46 county and district law presidents in Ontario, and the members of their respective associations tend to be frontline lawyers in private practice and small firms and you know, sole practice shops across the province. So, you know, some of the issues that, you know, John was describing at the outset are ones that are near and dear to our membership, and we've certainly been doing our best to talk about them and try to educate the public on some of these concerns as these issues unfold. Myself, I'm in private practice, largely in northwestern Ontario. Our firm is based in Fort Frances.
Thank you very much for that, and thank you again for participating today. Dan?
Yeah, my name is Dan Lang, and along with Jimmy Black, who you see on the screen, he and I started the Compassionate Justice Series about 14 years ago, and we've been running it probably over 50 events now, and so obviously that's why we're here today. This is our pioneering area of actually going to podcasting, and none of us members of the group are lawyers. I'm sort of third generation that escaped being a lawyer, and so that's my story.
Especially escaping being a lawyer. You have no idea how lucky you are. Jim?
Well, yes, as a guest here, as a colleague of Dan and Ben's, but what I can add to that is the fact that I was a former professor of political science and taught for so many years young people and introduced them to the values of democracy and the importance of an independent judicial system. And then along the way also was active in the early days of the Ontario Judicial Education Network set up by Roy McMurtry and nurtured by him while I was there, at least. So, yes, a vested interest, but never an officer of the court, yes.
Oh, that's actually, again, very good news. I think it's important that there be extensive discussion of these issues among people who are not directly involved in the system. And Ben?
Yeah, I only got into the criminal justice area more recently in my life. I had a long career as an academic and government policy person in a different field. And then I had my own collision with the criminal justice system, which ended that career, but got me using my skills and experience in criminal justice as I started to think about that as a field. And particularly, I'm interested in and have a long time interest in the relationship between research, policy, and practice in various fields. So that was one of my academic areas of study and still is. So now I'm doing a variety of volunteer things, including working with being part of the Compassionate Justice Group. But I also edit a blog on criminal justice issues for the John Howard Society of Canada that's now in its seventh year, I guess. We have about nearly 250 posts up on a wide variety of issues. And I would expect that we will be posting, often drawing on the work of researchers and academics. And I expect we will be posting about this issue as well.
Well, confirming that we truly have an all-star cast today. Well, so we understand what prompted this was Premier Ford stating, well, you know, I'm going to appoint tough, like-minded judges, you know, and we're going to get these people locked up, et cetera, et cetera. I think to better understand that, it would be helpful to have a sense of how judges are selected in Ontario and what the history of that is. I'm wondering if, Norm, could you take us through that?
It's a long story. I'll make it about 1 minute. In the 80s, Ian Scott, who's the Attorney General at the time, decided that the way of appointing judges was, in his view, too political. And so he devised the Judicial Advisory Appointments Committee, choosing people from the communities where a judicial vacancy comes up, putting them, the leaders of those communities, along with judges and some lawyers, on a committee. But there was a lay portion of it, so that it wasn't just judges picking judges or politicians picking judges. It was the community where that judge was going to sit that they handpicked people who they thought would have some input into choosing a judge that the community would understand how it was done. It wasn't done just by, okay, well, we've got a conservative government, let's appoint a conservative judge. He wanted to take the politics out of it. And so what happened was, and that was in the early 80s, the Judicial Advisory Appointments Committee would interview candidates. If a vacancy came up, let's say there'd be 600 applications. Well, they'd narrow it down to 60 and they'd interview maybe 15 or 20, and then they would put a list to the Attorney General. It used to be they would just put one, and then they put two. The Attorney General would have to choose from that list that they gave him or her at the time.
No discretion, yes, for anybody else. Restricted to the list provided.
Yes, that's right. And that way, the committee would say, well, here are the two top candidates that we've interviewed. Here they are, Attorney General. You can choose which one, but you must choose one of them. And that's the way it worked. And so judges then were appointed by a committee of people. They weren't appointed because of any political stripe. Hopefully, they were chosen on merit and experience and whether they would make a good judge. What is a good judge? We can get into that later. Tough, soft, sometimes tough, sometimes soft. Anyway, I have my ideas about that, and I don't want to hog the conversation. But that's how it started in the 80s. And it became very, very popular with other provinces, other countries. They adopted this system of a committee choosing the judicial applicants. And so it's been working. And the quality of the bench since then, in my view, has spoken for itself. And whether you came from the Crown system or whether you came from the defense system or whether you came from a different racial background or a different, you know, it didn't matter. They chose a person that they believed on merit would make a good judge. And now, at this point in time, we're starting to interfere with that. And I'm not blaming the premier. This isn't slam the premier time. And my book, You Be the Judge, started in a classroom of grade 12 law students where I tried to impress upon them that if you want to attack somebody's decision, attack it rationally and reasonably. Don't attack the person. What's wrong with the idea? And so we'd go into classrooms and I'd give them a case and I'd say, what would you do? And the students would say, well, I'd send him to jail. And somebody else said, well, I wouldn't. Then I would say, why? Why would you do that? And they would have to express their opinions. And then the people would disagree with her. I don't like the way this has become a slam Doug Ford issue. I disagree with what he said. I think he's getting bad advice. And I'd say, let's sit down and talk and tell you why I think it's wrong.
Well, the way you describe that, it sounds to me as though this process that began in the 80s was really a delegation, was intended to be a delegation by the government of the day back to the community impacted to make the decision on who the judge should be. Would that be a fair statement?
That's a really good statement, John. Yes, that's it. In a nutshell.
All right. Okay, well, I'm actually, you know, full disclosure, I'm pretty much learning about this in this discussion, for better or for worse. It's because I've never really had any interaction with the court system in my personal life. I've never had occasion to think about it that much. But I think that, you know, that my saying that speaks volumes, you know, really about the problem, that, you know, this is not something that people think about and they should be thinking about. Okay, so not only did Premier Ford make the statement of, you know, appointing like-minded judges, but I understand, if I'm reading correctly, that he's actually proposing changes to the existing process. Do we agree on that generally or not?
He's already instituted changes to the process that was just described. So back a few years ago, you know, you heard that the Attorney General would receive this shortlist from the judicial appointments. We call it the JAC, the Judicial Appointments Advisory Committee, and the Attorney General would have to choose from that list. I think it was back in 2019 or so, the Attorney General changed that such that the shortlist was longer, and if he did not like the list, he could send it back to the committee. This was met with some initial alarm from the legal community, in particular the people who make appointments to the committee itself, including my organization, because it sort of took the wind out of the sails of the independence that it's supposed to create some buffer around, to say to sort of allow more mischief to interfere in the process. Not only that, but as organizations that appoint individual to that committee, which is supposed to be, I think, a bit of a kind of a council of Elrond of people in the legal profession who can assess somebody on merit, we also have to now give a short list for appointment to the committee. We don't get a direct appointment. So there's a lot more room for tinkering politically if the Attorney General or Premier of the day wishes to, because of how they have restructured that within just the last few years.
So in other words, it's sort of, you know, if we like and agree with what you're doing, no problem. But if we don't, we're going to force our way into the discussion a little bit. Would that be a fair way of saying
it? You know, I don't want to cast aspersions on appointments that have been made, but certainly the door is open for that exact type of interference.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was not intended to cast aspersions on any.
Oh, I know. Just for listeners.
Yeah.
John, can I ask Douglas, those moves, do they represent an incursion into and a threat against the independence of judges and the adjudicators?
Well, you know, I think the political pushback on those earlier changes was fairly limited because it was a little bit of inside baseball to the legal community. The more recent commentary from the premier, I think, has been greeted with far more pushback, far more outrage, because it's far more overtly political. You know, the premier has essentially said that they want to appoint people that will lock people up. the suggestion is that they want to appoint people who come from their partisan ideology. And I think that people innately understand why that is problematic a little bit more than perhaps a government in good faith wanting a bit more control over the process. So I think that there's been an iterative process of moving the goalposts on what this selection process looks like. Cynics might say that the premier has only said the quiet part loud, but perhaps those who are more institutionalists and care about, you know, the rule of law and the independence of the judiciary would suggest that your responsibility in government is really to safeguard the independence of the judiciary and to, you know, regardless of whether you have a majority or came in on a sweep, you know, that is one of your responsibilities to the public is to protect that institution so it can hold you accountable as an elected government.
You know, I think you make a fantastic point there about the importance of the independence of the judiciary, but I also think that it's not a point as important as obvious it is after you think about it that many people consciously think about it at all. So I think this might be a good moment, and I do think this is needed for some commentary on why it's so important to have an independent judiciary. I mean, this is like a big deal. Who would like to sort of take that on as a general principle of civics or whatever?
Jim? Don, I can take it up 30,000 feet and a little more diffuse, but drawing from a speech by Rosalie Abella, she has learned that democracy is strengthened in direct proportion to the strength of rights protection and an independent judiciary. And that injustice is strengthened in direct proportion to their absence, and that underlining the need to fiercely protect that, and that there are political and more seminal threats to the values that make up our identity.
And by the way, a shout out to Compassionate Justice at this moment. Justice, or former, well, I guess still Justice Rosalie Abella will be speaking at the Compassionate Justice meeting on April the 7th, 2024. And that should be a fantastic event. And I would encourage anybody and everybody to attend that. And now back to our regular programming.
Can I make an observation? I think in part why this is gaining such sensitivity right now is that in the larger context, we're looking at democracy being threatened. We're seeing it around the world. We're seeing what happens when partisan takes over the management of the judicial system in the United States. And look at the appointments to the Supreme Court in the last year. So we've got evidence around us beyond Ontario that here are the consequences of not having an independent judiciary. It's not a hypothetical question. We're seeing it.
I think that's right. You know, the way I sort of view this is that, you know, when people talk about this, you know, they talk about, well, you know, we want conservative judges. We want people who are tough on crime. I mean, if you really analyze it, I'd be a lot more afraid of the lack of independence in the selection of judges than I would about any one individual criminal in our society.
We also want, you know, there's a concept we talk about, and, you know, I think Norman has some great comments on this, about the importance of upholding public confidence in how we administer justice. And I think that, you know, the simple way I've explained it, even to people in my family or in my community that have, you know, seen that I've made media comments on this issue that's emerged, is to say, well, you know, if you're a person in court, say you've been criminally charged or your kids might be taken away from you or you're in some other kind of dispute like that, would you feel very good if you felt the decision maker was on the same team as the other party? Like, that's what it comes down to. Like, in the most simple terms, that is the sensation we want to avoid, because that's really what it's about. The primary litigant in most of the courts that we're talking about provincial courts, which only hear criminal matters and some family matters in Ontario, the primary litigant is an agent of the state, of the province, the same people who make the appointment.
I want to just say, Ben wants to say something, and I don't know whether his mic is on. I've been noticing him, and I think you're muted.
I'm on now.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Norm. Yeah, to me, you know, John, you mentioned judges who are, and the premier has also talked about judges who are tough on crime. But as a person who studied the evidence on this, here's what we know. Tougher judges are not going to diminish crime. Stronger sentences are not going to diminish crime. We now have a huge amount of evidence on this around the world.
And more conclusion, jails.
Yeah, exactly. The conclusion of criminologists is that putting more people in jail and keeping them longer probably increases crime, certainly does not reduce crime. So the whole basic premise behind this, which is the way to address public safety, is by having more people jailed for a longer time, is just false. And this is one of the things that I found coming to criminal justice, is that this is a field that, to an incredible extent, is just uninterested in the evidence, which is ironic. I'm using the evidence here in the sense of research evidence. But many fields, there's a big gap between what the research tells us and what we choose to do. But in criminal justice, our choices often are the exact opposite of what the research is telling us. So we are spending billions of dollars every year and making many, many people's lives a lot worse without achieving any goal at all. In fact, moving away from our goal, which is improve public safety. And that's what I find most distressing about all this, is the absence of attention to what the evidence is telling us we should do.
Maybe continue with that. Why? You know, why do people not pay attention to the evidence? I mean, is this some emotional, oh my God, we got to get rid of these people? I mean, what is it?
I think there's an answer to that. How many people have actually witnessed a case from start to finish in a courtroom? How many people have been in a criminal courtroom? People read headlines and there's crime is on the uprise. And so they react to that. And the only time that they really get interested, and this is why I say, we need judges who are kind and compassionate when they can be, and tough when they must be, because there are violent people out there that we need protection from. So let's assume that your child or your teenager or your spouse or whatever, somebody close to you, is charged with a criminal offense and they're innocent. You know they're innocent. They know they're innocent. But there's evidence enough to charge them, and they end up going to court. What are you praying for? A tough judge? A tough prosecutor? You want a judge who will take each case separately. I was known as Stormin' Norman, tough prosecutor, in my Crown Attorney days, and I got appointed, and people thought, ooh, there's going to be a tough judge. Okay? I was tough when I needed to be. I was compassionate, I think that's my record, when I could be. And so you want a judge who will take each case as it comes. And so I had a woman plead guilty in front of me to impaired driving. She blew 140, the limit is 80. And when I heard her story, I struck the plea. Now I got appealed, I got overturned. But the story was so compassionate that she needed her license so badly for her kids. Her husband had left her and she was left with three kids. She had driven down her country road to her mailbox to get her welfare check and ended up in the ditch. And a cop came along, and rightly so, she was drunk, charged her, she pled guilty. I wouldn't convict her. I was wrong in law. But you take each case as it comes. If you can get a judge that can do that, and that's what all my colleagues do, hopefully. But we just, you know, the public reads a headline and, oh, that judge is too soft. Maybe or she was soft in that case. Maybe there was a reason that you didn't read beyond the headlines. Or that judge was too tough. I sent a 83-year-old first offender to jail for 6 months for writing graffiti. You can read about these cases, by the way, in my book. But you can't broad brush everything.
Yeah.
That's why we want judges who take each case as it comes. Forget the reputation. Forget what the politics are. Forget if it's going to be popular or unpopular. You do what you think is right within the parameters that you have. And in that drunk driving case, I went beyond the parameters, and I admit that. You can't have, you know, I was rightfully corrected on that, although the end result was bad, I thought. Anyway, I'll let somebody else talk now.
Norm, that sounds like law. Judicial discretion can be informed by compassion sometimes as well.
Absolutely.
Norm, I'll make a comment around this too, in terms of the public's reaction. Most of us have nothing to do with the criminal justice system whatsoever. We have no direct experience, you know, 80-90%. And so all of us basically form our view of the justice system by what we read in the newspapers.
Absolutely.
And so what do we read in the newspapers? Horror story, fire in Tonawanda, away we go. And we get this impression that things are actually getting worse. Crime is now worse than it was, say, 5 or 10 years ago. What instigated our series 14 years ago was a presentation by Tony Du, who is the grandfather of Canadian criminology. And Tony basically pointed out, you know, actually for the last 20, 25 years, we've had a declining rate of serious crime in Canada. And yet the same 25 years, we've got an increasing rate of incarceration. What's going on? And this is the issue.
So to come back to that, John, I think, because I've thought about this a lot, both in criminal justice and in other fields, I think what makes criminal justice different is a few things. First, it's a field that generates intense emotion, and especially fear and anger. And when people are angry and afraid, they are not at their most rational, and they are not really interested in what the evidence says. So we see this in the reaction in courts and the way criminal cases are covered, as if the only thing that anyone can get out of this, any victims can get, is revenge. We never use that word, but that's actually what's going on a lot of the time. It's about people wanting revenge, which is a very basic human desire, if you look back at history and how we've conducted ourselves. So that's one thing. It generates a lot of fear and anger, and those emotions are very powerful. The second thing is that the media love to cover crime. If you actually look at what gets covered, and this is not just true in the mainstream media, it's even more true on social media, anything that's sensationalist, there's some interesting data which we've got on our blog showing that while murders comprise some tiny proportion of all criminal offenses, they get about 60% of all the coverage of criminal offenses. So people get a completely distorted view of what's actually going on. But I don't blame the media for this, in a sense, because they cover it because people want to read it. And you can go back 200 years, the newspapers were full of stories about crime and weeks-long coverage of big trials. This is not a new thing at all. This is feeding also something very primal in us, our interest in these very unusual, sensationalist, grotesque, horrible things that people do to each other. And then the third thing is that it's a very potent political issue, because politics, unfortunately, is also driven to a great extent by emotion. So politicians love to talk about tough on crime. Dan's quite right. Crime's been declining in Canada. It's kind of flat in the last 3 years, but over 25 years, we see a pretty big decline. And yet, when you ask people, most people believe crime is getting worse. And that gets used for political purposes, as we see in the whole tough on crime agenda. And the Liberals, for example, all the promises they made in 2015 about all the changes they were going to make, virtually none of which were implemented, because the political cost to them, they felt, was too high to do those things, even though they knew they were right.
So it's almost as though, you know, when Premier Ford says, we want people who are tough on crime, what he's really saying is, I understand your fear of crime. I understand that this is an emotional issue for you, and I want you to know that I'm on your side, that I understand you. I mean, is that sort of part of what this is?
Well, that's his role, though, right? Like, he is a political actor who's democratically elected, and he seems to be he's sailing on the sea of public sentiment. And I think, as Ben has pointed out, people have this impression that crime is rampant and that we need to do more to address crime, despite evidence to the contrary. And so that is his role as a democratically elected head of government. I think where he has strayed is, he has crossed a line into interfering with another branch of government in a very serious way that I think that really should shake all of us for, you know, I think the reasons Dan described is that it's an attack on basic accountability measure that we have in a democratic system. And that's really where I think that the inclination to respond to crime politically by people who are elected or seeking election needs to have some guardrails. And we are seeing our political environment losing guardrails all over the place. So you mentioned media loves to cover crime. There's lots of crime reporting. I'm using air quotes. This is about an audio recording, but I'm using air quotes on social media as well. I think that it also calls on those who are participants in the justice sector, so like I mean specifically courts and lawyers and others, to do a better job, I think, articulating their work and what the process is about to the public so people understand that. One thing that we are seeing a lot is that in communities across the province, across the country, media is retracting. They don't have the same resources to cover things in depth, to follow a trial that might take place over months or even years. They don't have the ability to provide all of the detail. And a lot of lawyers, for various reasons, are hesitant to, I think, speak publicly in a way that might be prejudicial to a client. And I think that we need to find other venues to sort of provide information to the public about how things are supposed to be. And we've seen some of our institutions do this. So the Supreme Court of Canada publishes plain language summaries of decisions now. And we're seeing a lot more access to court decisions through Canley, which is a database of court decisions, which is far better than it's ever been before. I would really like to see more media coverage actually link people to the source material so that they can, develop an informed opinion for themselves. So that even if we are operating in this reduced media landscape, there is an ability for people to learn more about what goes into how that sausage is made in our system.
Well, that's the positive, the drawing back the curtain on the justice system, because these comments that have been made have engendered a lot of discussion, a lot of interest. And we judges know that a lot of the people don't really know what's going on in our workshop. I've been in the courtroom for 50 years, and I know that giving access to the public and as to what actually goes on is a good thing, which is why I went to schools and I played this game with the law students that engendered the book. But yes, the more open we are, the better it is for all of us, and that's why I think this is a good thing. What's happening in the last couple of weeks? I welcome it. I think it's great.
Pulling back.
It's interesting what our speaker series, over the last 14 years, I think about what's the most common form of feedback or observation I've heard over the years. And it's thank you for doing this. We're public education.
Yeah.
And people are deeply appreciative, both who are in the profession in some capacity, and those people are lay people from the outside.
I think that's absolutely correct. Doug, we talk about this theme of, pulling back the curtain, public education, better awareness, all these things. I think lawyers are important people, okay? I know I'm in a minority, but I think that lawyers are important people. And I think that lawyers are actually uniquely positioned to take a leadership role in providing, sort of public education. And I'm sort of curious, I'm presuming you would agree with that. I'm sort of curious what you think the legal profession could be doing to, heighten awareness on these issues and perhaps some education.
Well, if I could take a poke, I think right now, I'd say that as a self-regulated profession, so for those who don't know, lawyers and paralegals are regulated by the Law Society of Ontario. There's other law societies in other provinces. I actually think that much of that mandate falls to the Law Society to do on our behalf. It is somewhat perilous, for me to say, go out and try my client's case in the court of public opinion while a legal matter is unfolding in a courtroom, and the client, might not want that. It could be very prejudicial to their interests. But I think that the Law Society has a statutory duty to uphold the rule of law in Ontario, to promote access to justice and all these themes that are tied to those concepts. And so, in the aftermath of the Premier's words, which very much have put the independence of the judiciary in the crosshairs, a lot of the discussions I've been having is, why isn't the Law Society doing more to sort of uphold, you know, the integrity of the system, to speak about what the role of lawyers and the other participants are, and to help people understand that. Because I think one of the uglier parts of this political episode that's playing out is that it reflects a trend of punching down on institutions or professions that perform really important functions in our society that aren't in a position to engage in political warfare with you, right? Like, it's not like judges or justices of the peace can put out a press release to defend their integrity, right? They can't do that. They can only speak through their decisions relating to the matters that are before them in court. And we're sort of seeing this in other parts of the country, is, you know, making the opposition party some part of society, some sort of function in civil society that doesn't have a political platform to attack. And like, we see that a lot, particularly in education lately with teachers and others. But I think it's especially disturbing in court, because it raises the specter of like, am I going to get a fair day in court with one of the people this government appoints, if this is their selection criteria, if there's a litmus test for being tough on crime. So that's, you know, really what this comes back to. And I think that the Law Society of Ontario has a really important job to play in that. We're doing our part as, you know, a ragtag lawyers association, but, you know, I would certainly like to see the professional regulator do more on these issues.
Your view is they could be doing more.
Yes.
Okay.
I think Douglas makes a really important point there about the need for balance in the public debate. And one of the things about criminal justice is that it has a lot of actors who are not very well connected to each other. So you have the world of law and lawyers and courts, which is constrained, as Douglas has pointed out, for very good reasons, often in what they can and should say. Then you have the academic world of criminology, which is often not very well connected to the legal world. So that input doesn't happen the way it could. And then you have the whole NGO world of organizations that are either directly involved in criminal justice, like John Howard, for example, which I'm connected with, but also a whole variety of other community groups that have an interest in this. For example, Indigenous groups, because we know that Indigenous people are vastly overrepresented in the criminal justice system, or even taxpayer groups who, in my view, have an interest in having their tax money spent in better ways than more jails would do. So you have a lot of potential players here, but what you do not have is good forums for those people to come together, to link, or coalitions that help people make that argument in the public debate. We get a lot of great op-eds that are, you know, that appear by people who really care about this deeply, but it's one-offs here, there, and the other place. One of the things we used to have in Canada was the Law Reform Commission, which had the job of doing that. Now, I'm not sure that's the exact right model, but some kind of vehicle that draws together the evidence and puts it in front of Canadians in a nonpartisan way, not to make partisan political points, just to say, here's the facts, ladies and gentlemen. That, I think, would be a very, very helpful thing to have happen in criminal justice.
Well, you're really speaking to the importance, as I think, a general theme of having an informed citizenry. You know, how critically important this is. I think, you know, Jim makes this point earlier, to have a, you know, a really healthy functioning democracy, right?
Yes, but there's a caveat here too. I spent a lot of my life in government. And the thing is, there are a lot of public issues and citizens can't be knowledgeable about all of them or even most of them. At one time when I was working for government in another province, we did an inventory of how many public consultations that provincial government was doing at that particular moment, and it was 138. So that's one provincial government at one time doing over 100 public consultations. And the reality is most people can't be involved in most of that. So really the way it works is not so much by average citizens, but through the organizations that people create for various purposes, whether they're professional organizations, charities, political organizations, that's the means through which the political discussion really happens.
And connecting, and as you point out, connecting these groups,
yep,
you know, for discussion. Well, you know, I mean, I think that's, you know, that's a role that perhaps Compassionate Justice Group, you know, through the speaker series has kind of accidentally assumed, right? you know, which is one of the great things about it.
John, I think let me also reintroduce the business of the Ontario Judicial Education Network and fathered by Roy McMurtry and directed at high school teachers who are teaching the grade 12, 11, and 12 law courses, and with regular workshops. And his contention was that this has to be part of the curriculum, and this has to be part of the value system that these students are exposed to. And by the way, another friend of our Compassionate Justice, Eddie Greenspan, preached this endlessly, that the importance of defense lawyers against the massive resources and competencies of the state, that this has to be understood, that and certainly both those people, Eddie and Roy, spent many of their waking hours making that happen.
Absolutely. I mean, the importance of, I mean, somebody once told me, I think put this very, very well, that it's really only the criminal lawyers and the criminal defense lawyers where the lawyers make a huge difference. That may be a bit of an overstatement, but boy, you know, there's no doubt that the criminal defense lawyers play an incredibly important role.
Well, let me just say amen to Jim, because, you know, we judges, we're kind of restricted what we can do or even say. You wouldn't get a sitting judge on this panel, for example, on a political issue. We're just not allowed to. And we are very limited, and hopefully the tradition of lawyers speaking up when judges get slammed, because the judge can't speak for herself or himself in the media. So, you know, what we can do, we can go into the schools. We can have mock trials and participate in them with the high school students, which we've done. And the education prospect of it is really important. So as the young people start to understand what's going on in these issues, well, then let me just sidetrack and give you one quick story that's, I think, really interesting to all of us. I, on a sidelight, do an Elvis impersonation and sing in a band and stuff. And in 2019, we were doing a charity performance in London, and where I was judging at the time. And a young man came up to me on a break, and he said, "Judge Douglas, I went to school in Guelph, where you were a judge for all those years, and I'm now a lawyer in London. And I just wanted to thank you, because the day I decided to become a lawyer was when you came into our classroom in grade 12 and played You Be the Judge." And I mean, that was a priceless gift, you know? And so obviously, if we judges, as part of this group, not just criminal defense lawyers, not just prosecutors, but we can take a part in the education of young people. And that's, honestly, I don't mean to plug my book too much, but that's why I wrote the book. And one of the people who endorsed it, former Attorney General David Johnson, said this is what young people need. You know, they need to get involved in what's going on in our courtrooms. And from the mind of a judge, that's gold, you know. So amen to that, Jim, what you said.
Norm, once again, the name of that book, the title of your book?
Thanks, Jim. You need to judge.
Check is in the mail, Jim.
the one site where you can buy it, bethejudge.ca. May as well do it all.
You bethejudge.ca. Okay. You know, you mentioned, you know, both defense lawyers and prosecutors, which raises the question, and this has been raised in some of the articles. Should there be any, in appointment of judges, should there be any attention paid to a balance between defense lawyers and prosecutors and that sort of stuff? I mean, I can see from recent articles on this that there's been some concern with, you know, too many former prosecutors or this or that. And what are your thoughts on that? Or what are anybody's thoughts on that?
So I think that, you know, actually this morning, the Globe and Mail published an article indicating that over two-thirds of the Ford government's judicial appointments have
been former. This is the Marcus Gee article, correct, today? Marcus?
I don't recall the article, but I
well, this is brand new. John.
Sorry?
This came out this morning.
Yeah.
Okay. I just to everybody.
Yeah, I don't recall if it's Marcus or Jeff Gray, but from the Globe and Mail, it speaks to 2/3 of the Ford government's appointments being former prosecutors. Now, obviously, there's some data holes we don't know, right? We don't know what the pool of applicants looks like because that's confidential. We don't see that. But it would certainly seem that it would be in the public interest and consistent with the themes we're talking about of independence, of having a merit-based process, that we're not stacking the deck with people that come from one particular area of practice, one particular employer, one particular, you know, ethnic background, you know, you name it. And I think that is, you know, concerning. It starts to suggest that there is a preference. You know, some other interesting observations just in messages I've received this morning since that article came out is that, you know, not only does it cast a shadow on, I think, the suitability of defense counsel for that work, and I think defense counsel are well suited to that work, many of them are, but it casts sort of a shadow on what the nature of people in that line of work are. Like, we're talking about people who are very hardworking. They're out there to basically, they have to eat what they kill. They are on the billable hour, on the clock. These are not public servants. And they're people that are effectively business owners, you know, so it's and entrepreneurs. So it's very interesting to see, I think, the current government in its commentary sort of cast aspersions over this group of people that I think bring a lot of, you know, terrific advocacy that benefits the bench, that improves public respect for the bench and ensures that there's balance on the people deciding their cases. I don't know that this is an appropriate, that a quota is an appropriate means of striking balance, but certainly we want to make sure that however we're insulating partisan interference in the selection process, whether through the JAC or some new process that might be developed in the future, we want to make sure that we are assessing candidates on merit. And that's what's supposed to happen in order to make sure that the institution lives up to the important work it has to do.
Doug, I have to say this. It doesn't matter. If you say we need 50% from the defense bar and 50% from the prosecuting bar, then we're going to have a better system. And my point is this. The JAC system picks the best candidate and of the people who have applied. And that's what you want. I was tougher on prosecutors than I was on defense counsel in courtrooms over which I presided, because I expected a high standard from the prosecutors. And if they came in with blinders on, or if they came in and didn't prepare their case, or if they came in and I saw something that I didn't like with them, I wasn't afraid to tell them. And some of the prosecutors would say, wow, you know, I thought he was a crown attorney. I thought he was one of us. Once you're appointed as a judge, everything else, you take an oath. And by the way, you're not appointed for life and nobody can control you. There's also another council called judicial council that if you attend to be, you know, all one-sided, you can bet that somebody's going to bring that to the attention of the judicial council. And, you know, you're going to get either reprimanded or you're going to get terminated. It's not like, okay, we're kings and we are queens and we do whatever we want. But I'm telling you that once you start saying, well, we need 50% here, we need 50% there, then you're opening up another can of worms about, well, we need to appoint, you know, this person, even though they're not as qualified as this person. You know, and this person would be much a better judge, but we'll go with this one because it just should not matter. And that's the whole purpose of the committee. We want to choose the best person.
Well, and I agree with that, but I would agree with all those comments. What I mean to say is we want everyone from different parts of the professional community to be equipped to apply and to have their merit.
Well, absolutely.
I think that's what Douglas has said is the key point. I want to broaden it beyond prosecutors and defense attorneys. And of course, quite a few people do both. They work in one and then they work in the other. But I want to broaden it to say that we want judges to be a more diverse group of people. Like here we are, you know, six older white men talking about this issue. And really, it would be pretty unusual these days to have this event without thinking about the diversity of the panelists. So I think that also applies to judges. And it's not a matter of quotas, but it is very much a matter of who's in the pool. And to Douglas's point, how we encourage people to apply. For example, when affirmative action really began for women in many fields, one thing we realized is that women were less inclined to apply. So we needed a process that encouraged people. They weren't less competent or less capable. They were just less inclined to apply. So there's a lot of areas in which this works, not just professional background, but also other kinds of diversity that people have. And also the process through which people may feel that I'm the kind of person who could or should be a judge.
That's process. The JAC does encourage applications from minority groups, indigenous groups, and they make it that they want to see more applications from that those areas.
And we are seeing more people on the bench from those areas too.
Yep.
Having worked after I retired, that is to say, with a middle-sized legal publishing firm, and thus worked with the legal academic people, it became manifestly clear that the top 10% of the students were for the most part women. And that when I was out looking for authors, the best candidates in this case were again women. That we have seen a vast swing of the needle in this profession. And I think that has to be and will be recognized, I'm sure, in all.
I think, you know, the other thing we have to acknowledge, though, is that, you know, the premier's comments, I think, cast a chill on the willingness of people to apply if they don't think their application's going to be taken seriously. And because this is not an application to work at a fast food place. It is a significant effort. I'm sure Norm would agree with that. There's a lot of information that is required to be produced. It's a long process. It's not something that someone who is trying to run a business is taking lightly if they've made the decision to do that. And so to have the premier say that, you know, there's a hand on the scale, it is very discouraging. It doesn't help us achieve those goals of getting good diversity on the bench because we're not even going to see the applications to make it happen.
I agree with that.
Well, as we come sort of, you know, I mean, close to the end here, one thing that I noticed in the commentary about this was the premier's wanting to, did he say build more jails? I mean, I'm sure that I know what the response to that would be, but I invite any commentary on whether anybody thinks building more jails is somehow in the interests of any kind of reasonable justice system.
Can I tell you a story about that, John? Texas was very keen in building more jails, and they did. And, of course, they were all private sector jails that made lots of money. It got to the point in Texas that the jails were actually, all the people they were incarcerating in these jails was actually taking the state of Texas to a state of bankruptcy. And it was only at that point of near bankruptcy of the state of Texas did the Texas people wake up and say, we got to do something about this. And so what they started doing in Texas is they started treating a lot of the sort of everyday stuff that traffics through the court and diverting people into a system of support, social support, and encouraging them to find better ways to live so they don't wind up back in the system again. Within 2 years, they were able to shut down completely one huge jail because they started diverting people out of the system who are really not doing anything of any serious or consequential nature. So that's a bit of a learning piece around the value of building more jails.
John, you mentioned my article in 360 on tough judges. There's one coming out today called More Jails. And it's exactly along that line. We don't need more jails. We need more facilities. We need more drug treatment courts. We need more mental health courts. There's a lot of things we need with that money. If he's going to spend a lot of money on more jails, earmark it somewhere else, because if it's an overcrowded system, and I think it's laudable that that the premier is recognizing that it's an overcrowded system and there's too many delays, and good for him. But research who's in that crowd that's overcrowding the system and funnel them off. The violent people need to be locked away. The scheming criminals who prey on the vulnerable. Let's not forget, there's a lot of victims out there who, if anybody's listening to it, are rolling their eyes at these six white men who are so soft on crime. But there are people who need to be locked up. There are violent people who you can't cure. And we need jails. And I was never a judge who was afraid of locking people up. Now, I know that makes you squeamish, but more jails is not the answer.
Ben could perhaps talk to this, but the need for more resources given over to aftercare when people have been returned to society, and the efficacy of such organizations are beyond dispute in terms of lowering recidivism and the threat to the safety of society. And Ben.
Well, a couple of points on jails. Ontario is in the process of trying to spend $1 billion to build a new jail in Ottawa, which is being contested, but they're probably going to do it. Provinces across Canada spend $3 billion a year on essentially locking people up. But the real point to be made here is that 70% of the people who are in provincial jails in this country are on remand. They haven't been convicted of anything. And in fact, if you look, I have a blog post coming out on this today or tomorrow, based on a report that the CCLA just issued a week or so ago. If you look at the data, the number of people in provincial jails on remand has quadrupled over 25 years, quadrupled. Even as the crime rate has fallen, the number of people in provincial jails on a sentence has actually dropped very significantly. So our provincial jails are horrible places, worse than federal prisons, much worse than federal prisons for most prisoners. They are badly overcrowded, and they are badly overcrowded because we insist on putting people in jail and keeping them there before they've been found guilty. If we could resolve the problem of inadequate bail, which is, again, completely contrary to the public discourse, which makes you think everybody is getting bail no matter what, when in fact the opposite is the case. Bail has been getting harder and harder to get for many years, despite several Supreme Court decisions saying that we need to make bail more accessible to people. If we could resolve that, then we would also resolve the problem of the roughly 25% of all criminal charges, their administration of justice charges. That is, they're for people violating bail and parole conditions, many of them. But the bail and parole conditions didn't need to be there in the first place. We would actually free up a gigantic amount of court time, and we would not need to throw out serious cases because they've been going on too long and not meeting the Dort standard that the Supreme Court set. And we could reallocate some of that money to better services, as Jim has said, not just after people are released. About a quarter of the people released from Ontario provincial jails are homeless. And if we think that's a way to get people out of a life of crime by releasing them penniless and homeless, we're really whistling. So it's yet another area where we have the facts, we know what we ought to do, and yet there is a huge political movement to do the opposite of that.
I think that's actually a fantastic observation to formally end our discussion today, Ben. You know, I think we've talked about pretty much what we wanted to. But sort of in wrapping up here, I'd invite anybody to sort of add anything that should be added to the conversation.
Dan? I've said all I want to say.
Go ahead, Norm.
No, I just said I've said all I want to say. So
I was going to direct you to there's a public statement that three former chief justices of the provincial court released on March 6th. It's been reported in the Toronto Star. It's available online. It's about one page in length, but it's a terrific sort of civics lesson, I think, on the role of the judiciary in our system and why some of the discourse we've seen from the government is so problematic and harmful to their ability to perform those duties. So I encourage people to take a look at that if they're trying to get up to speed on this issue and what the concerns are.
Sounds great. Well, on that note, I want to thank everybody for participating in this today. It's been truly a privilege and an honor to be part of the discussion with you all. And, you know, once again, just sort of going from left to right on my screen, I've been speaking with Dan Lang, founder of Compassionate Justice, Norm Douglas, retired judge in Ontario, Doug Judson, who obviously practicing lawyer, playing incredibly sort of public service oriented role in getting these kinds of messages out, Jim Black, co-founder of Compassionate Justice, and as I think of him, scholar in residence when it comes to matters of criminology, Ben Levitt. So thank you everybody so much. This has been a wonderful discussion.
Thank you all.
Thanks, John.
Adios. Bye, adios.
Bye-bye.